You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Diego Velázquez is one of art history's greatest painters, and among his masterpieces is his 11 by 12 foot canvas, The Surrender of Breda. Anthony Bailey, who has written for The New Yorker for over 30 years, uses this monumental painting to tell the story of Velázquez's life. His book, Velázquez and the Surrender of Breda, The Making of a Masterpiece, is published by Henry Holt. I'm very pleased that it brings Anthony Bailey to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
The painting depicts one of Spain's few victories in its 80-year war with the Netherlands. Can you explain what triggered that conflict?
It was a dynastic mess, I suppose, that Spain had, the Habsburg Empire had spread, and one marriage after another, they seemed to acquire new bits of territory. They acquired willy-nilly the Netherlands, north and south, the Low Countries, and everything went to pot when the northern provinces got edgy and more Protestant, and the southern provinces got protective of the Spanish monarchy and stayed more or less Catholic. So there were dividing lines.
But we're talking about Spain, one of the world's greatest powers, financed by the riches of the New World. How could they have such a rough time with small Holland?
Yes, well, Spain was on the downward spiral, and small Holland, the gallant little Low Countries, the gallant Netherlands, was on the up. And it's very curious that there were two golden ages going on simultaneously. I mean, this fantastic explosion of art and talent in the northern provinces, and still a number of genius painters in the south.
Well, you've written a previous book about one from the northern provinces, Vermeer.
Indeed, yeah.
And in Spain we have Velázquez, we have Zurbarán, some incredibly great artists in a time of terrible turmoil. This war went on for 80 years, from 1568 to 1648. Why did it last so long, and was it so bloody?
I think the bloodiness actually was in the first part of it. That's when Spain got the reputation for being, thoroughly wicked. The Duke of Alva was going around slaughtering everybody in every town he captured. After about 1620, when there was a truce, I think things became an awful lot less savage, and you got fewer of the crosses and gibbets and torture racks set up all over the place.
Well, this was one of the few major victories of Spain in this war, which Spain ultimately lost. How did the loss affect Spain?
I think very, very slowly, and they pretended not to pay any attention to the fact that the whole country was going to hell in a handbasket. The royal court, for which Velázquez worked as a kind of organization man, he was a staff painter for the the Habsburgs, and the show went on. They produced pictures, they produced these exhibitions, they produced great theater events and extravagances.
Well, because he was a court painter, is that one of the reasons he chose to make a painting about this particular battle, one of the rare victories?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, they had a new palace, which a vast amount of money went into being put up for the royal family. That was called the Buen Retiro, and it was meant to be a nice country retreat right on the edge of where the Prado now is in Madrid. And for the purposes, they decided to have an exhibition with pictures of Spanish victories. And so Velázquez who had the job of really sort of curating the whole thing, had the right to pick which ones he wanted to do. And he thought, well, I'll do Breda. He'd never been to Breda, but he had taken a ship from Barcelona to Genoa with one of the passengers on board was Ambrogio Spinola, who was the captain general of the Spanish army at the siege of Breda. And so he got to know Spinola, and when this exhibition time came round, he decided to do a picture of the surrender of Breda.
From what he'd heard from Spinola. Accurate do we know if it's an accurate depiction of what happened?
I think it's pretty accurate. Velasquez never went there. He never set foot in the Low Countries, so it was all done out of his head and with Spinola's help, and also the help of an illustrated map of the siege, which has a lot of description of the event. But there's no... The picture makes it seem as if the painter is viewing the scene of the surrender from a hill, and there's no hill. I mean, it's the Low Countries, it's flat.
Well, we have a link on our show page to the painting and a number of close-ups of it. But what's happening here? A man is handing a key to the other man. Is that a sign of surrender?
That's the key of the city of Breda, and the man handing the key to the other man is Justin of Nassau, who was the governor of the town. And he is saying to Spinola, the general, okay, this is your city now. But the interesting thing to me is that Velasquez very cleverly sensed that this might not be the Spanish taking over from the Dutch forever. I mean, that the situation could very easily change. And there's something in the way Spinola is putting his hand on the shoulder of Justin of Nassau, the surrendering Dutchman, that indicates that, the situation could easily be reversed, as it was.
There's a lot of stuff going on in the background as well. Wonderful landscape behind. Again, looks like they're on a hill when they wouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. But is it at all odd that a horse's rear is one of the most prominent figures in the foreground?
One wonder, is that symbolic or not? I don't know. It's certainly a wonderful bit of painting. I mean, that black, I mean, it's a Franz Hals type black, isn't it? It's.
Well, I was wondering about other artists like Uccello and Caravaggio, that sort of thing that they might have done. Had Velasquez seen their work in Italy?
He was in Seville and, well, in the Royal Collection. He may well have seen Prince one. I don't know if he'd, but the Uccello, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Hunt in the Wood, and again, there you've got this motif of the lances, which is so powerful in the Velasquez picture.
They're sticking up on one side of the painting. They kind of throw it off balance if we're just talking about having some kind of symmetrical balance.
Yes, except you've got a bunch of Dutchmen who seem quite happy to have surrendered, standing to the left of Spinola and Justin, and who seem to be very animated, and they are the human beings to whom one is drawn immediately, and so wonderfully painted.
Did he try to do real portraits of the people involved? There are rumors that he included himself in the painting.
I think that seems to be something that we're all prepared to go along with. But there are two or three self-portraits by Velasquez, and they do look remarkably like the man on the far right, who's wearing a big, rather flowery hat and has a big moustache with turned-up ends, and certainly looks like Velasquez, and meets one's eye, the viewers, as if there's some kind of complicity between us and him.
Now, you mentioned that this was a time, a golden age of painting in Spain and the northern countries as well, but also in Italy. I mean, we're talking about the 17th century, probably one of the greatest centuries in the history of art.
It is for me.
Do we have any idea of why? This painting is done 1634, 1635, but it just seems like everybody was aware of what everybody else was doing. We see this incredible influence of Caravaggio's Chiaroscuro sweeping across Europe for some reason.
Yeah. Well, it certainly affected Velázquez. But, I mean, it's also there with literature, too, isn't it? I mean, you've got Cervantes in Spain, and you've got Shakespeare and John Donne, who was... Donne actually went on an expedition to Cadiz, I think, and helped raid the port. And there are lots of correspondences.
My guest is Anthony Bailey, who's written Velázquez and the Surrender of Breda, The Making of a Masterpiece. It is published by Henry Holt. Often when artists become court painters, it has an effect on them. Mantegna, who was a revolutionary artist in previous century, suddenly stops developing in that way. He remains a great painter. What was the impact of being the official painter in the court of Philip IV? What impact did that have on Velázquez?
I think it turned him into a kind of a Spaniard of the sort we recognize, who was in no hurry to do anything, who was ceased to be totally ambitious. He seemed happy just to wander around the palaces, looking at pictures, moving pictures. Happiest to go off to Rome and buy new pictures, but he certainly lost his drive as a painter and seemed to be quite happy being what the French call a flâneur, you know, sort of not quite with his feet up. I think he was always busy as a.
But this painting is wonderful, and it has all of the things that we associate with Velázquez's painting, the way he painted fabrics, for example, and just the way he put figures next to each other. He loved to do these group scenes.
Yep.
So he still had it, but you're saying he lost his drive.
Well,
hadn't it been controversial that he was named the court painter in the first place?
I think the competition was great, and it was a good deal of jealousy, and a lot of other people would have liked to have been had his position.
Was there anybody out there who was even close to his equal?
I don't think so, no. I mean, it's certainly not visible now. I mean, someone like Zurbaran is wonderful at painting fabrics and wonderful at painting piety somehow, but he didn't have the... quite what it is. I mean, I'm not sure I still... But it's a mixture of absolute detachment with Velázquez and absolute intensity, and how those things fit together, I'm not quite sure.
Well, you have a feeling that his portraits of the royal family are very accurate, in the same way that you feel that Goya's portraits of the royal family a century later are really accurate. And I wonder how that could have happened, because usually court painters flatter their subjects.
Yeah. Well, neither did, and Velázquez got away with showing Philip IV. I've now just been looking in the Frick this morning, looking at that picture, and there's this man with terrible bags under his eyes, and a man who looks old before his time, and obviously hasn't got a lot standing up for him anymore.
Velázquez has many well-known paintings. His Las Meninas, the family of Philip IV, is probably more famous than the Surrender of Breda. Why did you decide to focus on this painting rather than that one?
Well, I focus on the Surrender possibly because I have this sense that there was something about the act of surrender which intrigued Velázquez. There was a connection there that I felt needed to be brought out, and it has to do with the fact that his career was very much, he was an organization man, and yet he was an individual, and somehow he handed himself over at a certain point to the court and the royal family, and never got out of that position. But as a painter, it didn't do him any harm.
No, these are two great paintings.
Yeah.
Well, how did he even come to be such a great painter? He grew up in Seville. Was that a place where many good artists came from?
It was certainly a place where, yeah. And he had the first master he went to at the age of 11 was a man with a very short temper, Herrera, who I don't think made much more of a dent on the progress of this wonderful talent. But he moved on to a man called Francisco Pacheco, whose wife crops up in a number of the early Velázquez pictures. So he was part of the family. You became a painter, a pupil, an apprentice at the age of 11, and for 6 or 7 years you stayed with that family, and you become a... So Pacheco was a very rigorous teacher, and I think very helpful to...
Well, how old was he when he went to Italy? Obviously, Italy was the place that you went to learn about the history of art if you were someone like Velázquez.
Yeah, I think he was about 29, 30 on the first trip.
And that was just 5 or 6 years before he did this painting.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
But probably the most famous painting of his that came out of the trip to Italy was the Toilet of Venus.
Yeah.
A discreet nude, but one that looks very Italian.
It's a very complicated picture because it's a naked woman lying on a sort of gray silk sheet, and it's got all the trappings of an erotic picture, and yet the eroticism is as low key and cool as you can get it. I mean, cool is a word that does crop up. In a non-fashionable sense about Velázquez, because he has this detachment. He stands back, and he's in absolutely no hurry. I mean, his phlegm, which was his the fact that he didn't get on with things fast, and he took his time. That was his noticeable characteristic, as far as everyone was concerned, the other members of the court.
And did that bother the king?
It didn't seem to. I mean, you get impatient. It would be impatient telegrams or emails nowadays, but the ambassador in Rome was told to, ask Velázquez to pull his finger out and get all those pictures back to Madrid.
Well, this is also a time when some artists could get involved in politics. Rubens becomes a diplomat. Mm-hmm. Did Velázquez have a political side?
I think it was a political side that about his own career. I mean, it's very curious to me that his ambition towards the end took almost entirely the form of whether he was going to get a knighthood, whether he was going to become a knight of Santiago. And, it's hard to imagine the importance anyone would attach to this nowadays, but that's all that seemed to matter. And to get that knighthood, he went through many hoops. He, he lied about his ancestry. Many people still taken in by Velázquez's noble background. He didn't have a noble background. One of his grandparents came from the rag trade. Was probably Jewish. Was probably a maker of pantaloons and corduroys, and that grandmother was illiterate, but the commission of the court of knighthood of Santiago was convinced or managed to convince itself that he had this noble background.
Well, wasn't his greatness as an artist important enough, or was he not recognized at that time as a truly great artist?
I think, well, in the court circles, he was certainly, I mean, they knew he was the best, and being recognized elsewhere was something that, it was a time before celebrity, it was a time before news magazines, and the world didn't really know about him until 100 years or so later when the French took him up.
And then Goya had to have been influenced.
Goya was influenced, and Goya seems to me a completely different sort of painter. I mean, Goya... Goya doesn't seem to have the center that Velázquez has. I mean, Goya was a man for all seasons, I think, and strikes me that a wonderful painter, but he doesn't seem to have the kind of central spine that Velázquez had.
How tied to a the country of the painter is a painter's reputation? For example, Spain, as you said, was going into decline here. Did that affect Velázquez's reputation?
Well, it did because his paintings were almost entirely done for the royal family. And so his paintings were only known by people who got to visit the court or got to visit the palaces.
When did that change?
That changed probably in the late 18th century when British art dealers were going around Spain trying to pick up various things, and the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars really, really changed everything, because the generals, the French generals, were trying to buy up Spanish pictures, and then people like Wellington, if they were lucky, found a carriage full of great Spanish masterpieces in the possession of a Spanish king that they'd just defeated.
Well, this painting and some of the other great ones are in the Prado. So I guess when the paintings started being dispersed, Spain considered some of them important enough to put in its great museum.
Well, yes. I mean, the royal collection remained and went when the Prado was set up. There they all were to be taken over. But a lot, I mean, the reason the National Gallery in London and Apsley House, which was Wellington's old home, have so many is because of the spoils of war, really.
And we have great Velázquez's in New York at the Met and at the Frick. There's great ones in Rome. One great one that I saw in Rome, the famous Pope
Innocent the Tenth.
Yeah. That Francis Bacon so loved. The Toilet of Venus is in London. But the two paintings that we most associate with him, The Surrender of Breda and also Las Meninas, are both in the Prado.
Yeah.
And we don't know much about this man's life for all sorts of odd reasons.
Well, he left very few letters, that are...
And people didn't write about him, other than he's great?
Some people wrote about him. Pacheco, his first master, wrote a kind of a very pedestrian memoir about his famous pupil. Reflected Glory was going to... And Palomino, who was a court artist in the following century, wrote quite a long and hagiographic piece about our man.
Anthony Bailey is a writer for The New Yorker. He's been there for more than 30 years, been called one of the best descriptive writers of his generation. And he's written 23 books, many of them most of them on artists, or all of them on artists? Turner, Constable, two books on Rembrandt.
Recently. I mean, you say I'm a writer for The New Yorker. I was a writer for The New Yorker, but when I became detached from that formerly wonderful magazine, I picked up an old ambition, which was to write about paintings.
And the latest one is Velázquez and the Surrender of Breda, The Making of a Masterpiece, published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you.